and I do mean a privilege. I am absolutely delighted with the people who have agreed to speak today of their experience and of their passion. And I'm glad to see so many of you here, and thank you for being here. I'm going to begin my convening remarks by quoting two scholars, one ancient and one modern. The people I've asked to speak today have disagreements with each other about some of the things that are on the table. And so I'll begin with my quote of a scholar ancient, St. Ignatius of Loyola. And what he said was, "Where controversy abounds, there flowers the fairest hope." And I hope there's controversy. And I believe that in discussing some of the disagreements, that's the way forward. And of course, as an academic, that's all we do. I have to quote a second scholar, otherwise I would be plagiarizing. And of course, with two scholars, it's research. So my second scholar is Heather Monroe Bloom, who works here as the president of the university. And in your packages, you'll find an essay of which she is the co-author, an essay about innovation and about Canada's issues. And she advanced in that essay six recommendations. And one of those recommendations was that we need to bring together academe, business, and government to discuss some of the innovation-related issues and the needs to better commercialize the innovations that our research labs and our industries are turning out. And the quote is a recommendation that we need to bring these people together. We need academe, government, and industry together. And that's what we have today. I'm delighted not only with who the panelists are, who the audience is, but also in the mixture. And that mixture will become apparent as we go forward. So that's the end of my very short welcoming talk. I'm going to introduce Dean Peter Todd, Dean of the Deshotels Faculty of Management, and he'll provide a more formal welcome to the faculty and the university. Dean Todd?
Thank you, Alan. It's a pleasure to be here with all of you and to welcome you to McGill, to welcome you into our world here at the university. And I wanted to say thanks as we start to Alan for convening this and pulling this group together, but also to my colleague, who I think is in the back, Hamid Etemad, who has been instrumental in developing commercialization, innovation, technology, innovation, entrepreneurship issues at the university over many years here, to Rod McNaughton of Waterloo as well, for their work in pulling all of these activities together, not just the symposium today, but the things that will unfold over the next several days here at the university. And I think it looks like with this group together, we're off to a wonderful kickoff. The roots of these activities at McGill, I mean, they go back a long, long time within the faculty, but the essence of the conference that will follow on from this symposium had its roots about 13 years ago or so, where Hamid tells me over a cup of coffee, but I know he's making it up because he drinks tea, he and several colleagues sat down and said, "Why do small businesses in Canada manage to succeed when they go internationally? Why do some succeed and some fail?" And the desire to understand that, and obviously to realize it's not just a Canadian issue, it's an international issue, and how does that happen around the world, and to think through those kinds of issues. Something that, of course, at McGill, as a truly international university, is near and dear to our hearts. And the conference itself quickly became a very international venture. The conference that will follow on from this symposium in the international entrepreneurship is held typically in alternate years here at McGill or somewhere else around the world. And this is the 13th, but I hope luckiest, iteration of that conference that's coming up this year. The symposium, I think, that you're having today also provides, as Alan's pointed out, a great opportunity for integration. Voices need to be heard from business, from academia, from government, if we're going to deal with issues of innovation and success. And you can't go through a day looking at the news, the newspapers, periodicals, other things in Canada and indeed around the world, where people aren't talking about the increasing competitive environment that we face. And in fact, this morning, if you flip into the Globe and Mail, you'll see Mark Carney talking about the need for Canadian firms to engage in a more multipolar way in the world to be competitive and to export our knowledge and talent. And so obviously you're here at an auspicious time to be talking about these things, but a critical time as well. Alan referenced this is an issue that's near and dear to the heart and mind, I think, of the principal, Heather Monroe Bloom. It's an issue that we're seized with in many ways at McGill as well. There are many, many initiatives across the university where we're trying to understand both how to commercialize, obviously, our own inventions, innovation, and technology, but to understand that process of translation and transition, and to do that in the context of an increasingly competitive global economy. And in that context, I think it's quite fitting that to give the broader view of all of this, we have the Provost of the University, Anthony Massey, here to say a few words to you as you get your day kicked off as well. So, Tony, welcome.
Thank you, Dean Todd, and on behalf of McGill University and our principal, Heather Monroe Bloom, welcome to McGill and welcome to this conference. I'd like to express real gratitude to Doug Barber for the initiatives that he has undertaken and to the accomplished group of panelists who you're going to hear today during this conference. We're sure that Professor Barber's debrief on the from research lab to marketplace will set a tone that will help us to understand these important issues. And as Peter has said, the organizers have done a marvelous job in bringing together a group of experts and people interested in this topic because it is an extremely important topic from the point of view of the development of Canadian business and entrepreneurship around the world. I think that's the important part of what's going on here. For 13 years, this group of people have been meeting because there's an important intersection between the development of entrepreneurship at the local level and the intersection with international business, and the ways in which those two traditions come together is what this conference has been all about. This is an exemplary group of people invited here today, and I'm really pleased that you all could be here and will bring your expertise to the topics that will be discussed today. The platform here is to develop a deeper understanding of very important issues related to entrepreneurship. But as Peter said, it also takes on a public policy framework. What are the incentives for business angel investment? How do you stimulate institutional venture capital? What is the relationship between the commercialization of an innovation and international trade? These are all pivotal things that you will be discussing in the conference in this conference. And it's also a way of understanding the direction in which international entrepreneurship is going. I'm the chief academic officer after the principal at McGill. I'm also the chief budget officer of the university. As Peter said, we face this issue all the time. How do we take interesting and important ideas or the declaration of an invention and transform it into an innovation that finds its place in the marketplace? Universities are continually in need of thinking about the ways in which the knowledge that they generate can, in fact, be transformed into things that are useful to people in their everyday lives. Our principal, as Peter pointed out, is passionate about this, and together with Peter McKinnon, the president of the University of Saskatchewan, they published a paper on science, technology, and innovation, the State of the Nation report, and I believe it's been reproduced in your packages so that you'll have an opportunity to take a look at it. Universities are key players. Yes, it's business. Yes, it's industry. Yes, it's government, and it is universities as well that need to play a role in thinking about how we move Canada's relative underperformance in innovation up a notch. The data that were presented in the McKinnon and Monroe Bloom paper indicate that Canada suffers because it has low business research and development. There is a poor connection between businesses and universities in terms of collaboration. And our own universities lack the kind of international visibility in terms of their inventions that are important. And I think these are the things that can, in fact, and why universities should play a role in these kinds of conferences. And the fact that we can bring people together who can articulate these arguments is extremely important. McGill is a very unique university in the Canadian context. We're an Anglophone university inside of a Francophone province, but we're also an extremely international university. Just about 20% of our undergraduate students come from countries other than Canada. And that's an important contribution to the understanding of international relations. We have them right here. Another quarter of our students come from somewhere else in Canada than Quebec. So we're actually an international and national university that brings students together from across, across the country and around the world. The same is true of our professoriate. We've recruited 900 new professors over the last 10 years, and they have come from about 42 different countries and have received their educations in about a dozen or so. So this is an important area for us to understand internationalization and to bring cultures and people together. This is one of the things that we hope you'll be able to think about in terms of the relationships of universities to entrepreneurship. Dean Todd spoke earlier about the ability to push forward the frontiers of international entrepreneurship as we strive together to do that. And again, universities, and McGill in particular, we think is a great place for that to happen. I hope that every one of you will leave this conference inspired, and I encourage you to explore the ideas and be creative about what it means to take chances and how you can link government policies to the practices that go on at universities, to the things that go on in your own business life. And the relationship is not only between entrepreneurs and small businesses, which are extremely important, we all know, in the context of Canada, but how these also relate to the larger scale industries in the country. I think this will be, and I hope you'll all have a very productive conference and enlightening few days. Let me now turn to another important issue, and that is to have the privilege of introducing your first speaker, world-renowned entrepreneur Doug Barber. Dr. Douglas Barber epitomizes the modern engineering entrepreneur. Through his leadership, Genom Corporation became the world leader in hearing and microcircuitry design and high-end broadcast video products. Today, its technology is found in more than half of the 6 million hearing aids sold each year. Genom's advances have made the devices more effective and easier to use, helping to increase their acceptance by the hard of hearing. Doug Barber co-founded Linear Technologies in 1973. The company, renamed Genom Corporation, has grown to serve a growing international customer base and is headquartered in Burlington, Ontario. A design center in Ottawa and subsidiaries in Japan and the United Kingdom. In 1998, Genom received the Ontario Chamber of Commerce Outstanding Business Achievement Award. After serving as a part-time professor at McMaster for over 25 years, Dr. Barber became a member of their Board of Governors and is the past chairman. In 2006, he was made an Officer of the Order of Canada, and other honors include the Hamilton Engineer of the Year, 1996, an honorary doctorate in engineering from the University of Waterloo, an honorary doctorate in science from McMaster University, and the Ontario Entrepreneur of the Year in Technology Award in 1999. Please welcome Dr. Barber as the first speaker of the symposium.
Thank you very much, Mr. Provost. It's a pleasure to be here at McGill, one of our very highly honored institutions of learning in Canada. And it's especially a pleasure to be here with such a broad range of people with interests in how we actually benefit from the knowledge that we have. My task this morning is to position our discussion a little bit in the light of the symposium that occurred on the 20th of May. Which this is a follow-up to, and I'm really glad that the follow-up is taking place. So let me just give you a brief introduction to provide some perspective, which many of you may already have, and many of you may have actually attended that symposium. But just bear with me, and I'll go back over what I think happened on that particular day, which was April the 20th at the University of Waterloo. It was a symposium arranged by the Dean's Advisory Council at the University of Waterloo, and they invited, and everyone was there by invitation, they invited about 70 business leaders, government officials, and academic administrators to engage in identifying solutions to Canada's commercialization problem. The problem was presented in three aspects. The first was that a very small percentage of Canadian technologies achieve commercial success. The second aspect of it is that of those technologies that form a basis for company startups, the failure rate in those startups is unacceptably high. And the third one was that very few of the companies that actually do succeed in realizing significant global sales or global revenues or global presence. So, three aspects. One is that very few of the ideas ever get anywhere. The second, that companies that get started fail. And the third is that those that succeed don't tend to succeed globally. So on those sort of three problems, the task of the symposium was set out to find solutions to the problem. It was not to debate the problem or to try and reposition the problem or anything like that. It was simply to find solutions to the problems. The participants at that meeting were encouraged to be open, honest, and respectful to one another, but completely open and honest. The symposium began with review of the evidence for the situation that we're in by five knowledgeable individuals. In the afternoon, there were three focus groups organized to brainstorm solutions to the three aspects that I talked about, with a moderator and a number of recorders present in each one of those brainstorming sessions. It was a remarkable day, a very remarkable day. I've been at a lot of things. I'm an old man. I've attended a lot of things, and the wide range of expressions and the openness of the people who were there made it an unusual experience just to be present. And I think left the scribes and the organizers with a very large challenge about how to synthesize all the things that had poured out during those brainstorming sessions. And I might say, just in passing, that one of the most remarkable things about that symposium was that the University of Waterloo actually managed to attract a significant number of commercial entrepreneurs who were actually successful and in business. And when I say remarkable, I was very much involved in one way or another after the January 2001 speech from the throne when Prime Minister Jean Chrétien announced the National Innovation Strategy to get Canada into the top five innovative economies of the world by this year, 2010. We haven't moved an inch. We haven't moved an inch in 10 years. But we had 30 summits across Canada that were organized at an expense in the region of $60 million to gain momentum and spirit and drive and direction for the strategy, for the innovation strategy of Canada. And Jeff Prelinston, who's here today, and Jeff and I have spent the 10 years since then studying the R&D intensive enterprises of Canada, because the enterprises always get the blame for this, for not being the receptor capacity, for not getting the business, for not doing the R&D, all those kinds of things. We always get blamed, and at that time I had just retired as the CEO of Genom Corporation, so I was in a new kind of freedom, and I've learned a lot about what we did unconsciously in Genom. But coming back to the National Innovation Strategy and the summits, one of the first things I did was to look at all those summits, because Jeff and I were already identifying the top R&D enterprises in Canada, and in fact had done that and realized that in 2003 or whatever year it was that we were talking about this, there were about 220 companies, a very small number, that invested more than $3 million a year and more than 3% of their revenue and were actually succeeding in business and were growing in business at a rate that if you projected it ahead, they could almost get us into the five, those 200 companies, 220 companies, could almost get us into the top five innovative economies of the world by 2010 if they kept doing what they were doing. They haven't kept doing what they were doing. A lot of them aren't in Canada anymore. They're still doing the kinds of things they were doing, but somewhere else. The most important thing, though, about the summit, and this is what I was going to do, contrast it with the session we had at the University of Waterloo, was that all those summits across Canada, not one of those 220 companies had anybody represented at the summit, and they were the players that were going to make it happen or not happen, and they weren't even there. And man, living when I thought about it, the worst part about this was we didn't even miss them. We didn't know they weren't there or even that they did matter. And we haven't moved far from that either. We still don't know. They are now about 270 companies, and their sales and revenues are less than they were in 2003, largely because Nortel is not doing what it used to do. Very sad for Canada, very sad for Canada. What I'm saying is you probably still don't know who those 270 companies are, nor do you probably care because they're all relatively small. They're not, they're not the size of the big mining companies or, they're not the size of the potash deal. These are relatively small, but they're vital. They're the ones that actually do the knowledge-based kind of stuff. So what I'm saying is Waterloo was different. Waterloo, in the opening remarks, had three entrepreneurs giving their perspective on the problem and on the solutions. So it was an unusual meeting. And I was very much encouraged by that and still am. And I'm hopeful that, in fact, we will not end up being an ongoing talk between bureaucrats and academics with no commercial people present. Because if it's about commercialization, you better have commerce in the room. And you better start talking about commerce, talking about research. By the way, that's the only offensive part that I find about it. The whole introduction is research labs to market. I can tell you that there is almost zero success in taking an idea from a research lab and getting revenue from it in the world. It doesn't happen. But we believe it does, and we can keep on believing that as long as you don't have commercial people in the room who have thought about what it takes to get business in China and business in Japan and business in Europe. Let alone business in North America. We fall into business in North America pretty easily. Well, you got me on a hot topic here. Let me switch and keep on with my report. By the end of May, the first draft of the Waterloo Manifesto was circulated to the attendees of that symposium. It had been a huge amount of work, and I have to recognize and acknowledge the kind of work that Paul Guild and his team did to pull that together in such a short time. And I think they received a significant amount of feedback back on it, which is another commendation. If people stay active, it's one thing to be at a symposium, and then it's all over, and whatever anybody writes about it is, it's in the sand. But in this case, I don't think that was the case, and I think there was a lot of feedback. So by the end of June, the revised version of the manifesto was completed and actually posted on the website, and I think you probably do have a copy of that. I haven't had a look at my package yet, but I suspect you have a copy of it in your package today. It is still a package that's an ongoing work, and I hope that it's ongoing work for all of us for a long time to come, because these are big problems that we're addressing that don't have simple, quick fix kind of solutions. So it's a work that's underway, and as far as I know, the participants have still provided feedback, and there's ongoing work, and Paul may say something about that later. So it was, I would say, a notable experience, and I hope this one is going to be the same, and particularly around the two areas that we're going to focus on here today. As one of the commercially experienced people, I just want, before I close this off, to make a few remarks about places where I feel we need to get more wide open to succeed. And when I say wide open, I'm saying the research lab word is a way too narrow. Anybody that's in commerce knows that that's a very small piece of what needs to be done. And the other thing that you know if you're in commerce is that markets do not ever place purchase orders or pay for anything. They don't have any money. Markets are just a generalization, which in the commercial world is known to be false. You have to have customers who actually buy and who actually pay for the value that you create. So, for me, we got to blow this thing much more wide open. And I think we can all cope with it. But because it's been a kind of a cuddly relationship between the academics and the bureaucrats, and I'm fairly familiar with both. I've lived for the last 10 years in the academic environment and spent a lot of time in it before. In fact, never escaped it. I've been in it since I was 16. It's hard to imagine. But it is too cozy an environment where you can actually reinforce things that aren't big enough or wide enough to solve the problem. And I just want to say we got to blow it open. And so a few things I just want to say. First, the definition of innovation needs to be much more encompassing. For me, innovation, and I'm a guy who comes from a Saskatchewan background, from a family that was recovering in the time I was a kid from the Depression and the drought of the 30s, where we had no money and where we invented innovation, by the way, the Bennett buggy. Bennett was the prime minister during all of this time, and during this time, the farmers on the prairies who'd been very prosperous in the 20s couldn't afford to put gas in their cars anymore. So what did they do? They took the engines out of the cars, put a Whipple tree on the front of it, and hitched their team up to the car. It was the most comfortable wagon they'd ever had to ride in. So their life was better, but it wasn't as good as it was in the 20s. But the Bennett buggy in some ways symbolizes the kind of innovation. I saw innovation all the time. People innovate on what they know with what they have. So knowledge is a very important part of the innovation process, but it is simply a part. So innovation is finding a way to improve our lives. And what I want to say about that is that if our lives are not bettered, if our lives are not improved, innovation has not succeeded. And we do a lot of innovating that doesn't reach the mark. Second, commercialization needs to be used in its complete sense. Commercialization is the steps taken to realize commerce. That's why commerce is part of the word. I actually hate these verbal nouns because you can get so mucked up on them that you don't know whether you're at the beginning or the end. But nevertheless, commercialization is simply the steps that you take to realize commerce. If commerce is not realized, commercialization has failed. It gets a big X and a big zero on the examination. And we do a lot in Canada of taking steps that can be important steps in the road to commercialization, and we get satisfied with the step that we've taken, and that's what we measure, and that's what we talk about with great pride, and we don't ever get the commerce. We have to measure the commerce. And if we don't measure the commerce, we're not serious about commercialization. And I have difficulty going to StatsCan and finding any kind of measures that allow me to determine how successful we are in the knowledge-based economy. But the ones that are there tell me that although we educate our people better than any other country in the world, we spend more of our GDP on the knowledge of our people than any other country, we are actually at the bottom of the OECD in our ability to create value for the world from what we know. We're really poor performers. We run deficits in the knowledge-based economy all the time. And even in the resource sector, and this is what really saddens me, where we have between 7, and I just came from Saskatchewan yesterday, 40% of the world's potash. So I now have to say between 7 and 10% of the world's natural resources. Now I say between 7 and 40%. We are a natural resource-rich country. With that much resource and 0.5% of the world's people, we ought to be prosperous. But we can be more prosperous in the knowledge-based area. I often wonder, why is it that all those little countries that are more prosperous than us in the world, and we sit about number 10 in the prosperity of nations, where we used to be in the top 5, who's moved ahead of us? All countries that have populations less than the population of Ontario. The only country bigger than us in population, above us in the prosperity of nations, is the United States. And the United States always sits up there near the top, generally number 2 or number 1. And we often think that we're like them, but I can tell you that if we're serious about it and we do the academic studies properly, even about how professors function in the United States, where they're paid for 9 months of the year, not 12 like us, that's a huge difference in the culture of a learning institution. But we don't look at those differences. Anyway, the Americans are up there ahead of us. But all those other countries, many of them sell us the technology to mine, to timber, to fish. They sell the technology to us. That's how they prosper. They do the knowledge work. We dig it up and do none of the knowledge work about how we dig it up or how we improve that. I got to get off my roll here. The other thing I wanted to say is that commerce, I just wanted to define commerce. Commerce is an exchange of value between two parties, generally involving currency on one side, and the party that's paying in currency is generally considered the customer. The question of whether commercial value has been created is determined by the customer. It has to be of value to the customer, or they're not going to pay you. That's one of the things you really learn when you're out there taking the beating in the international scene. If you're not creating the value best in the world, you're not going to be getting the money of the world. So it is the customer who has to decide whether value is being created. And that's why it can't be done in the quiet of a lab where you never have to interface with anybody other than your own mind and the team that you've got in the lab. You got to get in touch with the customers. Customers are absolutely key. You can generalize about some customers and call it a market, but as I said before, markets never place purchase order or pays bills. You've got to have customers. And you're not in business until a customer is paying you for what you do. You're imagining you're in business, and we do a lot of that in Canada. The startups, and we have lots of them, we have lots of entrepreneurial people in Canada. The startups and small and medium enterprise companies, actually, this value exchange is highly personal. It's very close quarter when you're a small company. When you get to be a big enough company where you have a reputation and a history, you can get a little bit more impersonal. And our problem is we're always thinking about our big companies. Why are we thinking that way? Well, as academics, you can't get any money from a startup or from an SME. They don't have any. Not enough, anyway, to fund any research or do anything like that. So they tend to get lost. And I might say as well, if you're talking about companies, it takes on, in a really good running company, it takes 30 years to get to 100 million in sales. And if we were to do what we need to do in the knowledge-based economy in Canada, we'd need 1,000 companies that size growing at about 20% a year. Do we have them? We don't. Do we have many at a billion a year? We don't. We don't. Even Waterloo doesn't have them. Waterloo has only one above 10 billion who's kind of replaced Nortel. That's RIM. And that's really Canada's only, it's about a $15 billion company in revenues right now. We don't look at those things. We talk about startups, but we don't know it's going to take us 40 years to get to anything significant. And if you talk about significance, look at the Americans. General Electric, this year, I think 108 years old, at about $150 or $160 billion in revenue, they've grown at about 18% a year over their history. IBM, about 100 years old this year. They've grown at about 16% over their 100 years. Hewlett-Packard, who's about 73 years old, has grown at about 17% a year over their history. And they're up there, as I say, about 73 years old. You can go to the United States and you can see knowledge-based enterprises that have been around for a long time. They're not doing anything like what they did when they started, but they're still growing and thriving on their brains. We don't look at things that way in Canada. We've got to get serious about commerce and how long it takes to get good in commerce. Okay, and that means you've got to be into very human stuff in the early stages where we largely are. So, the topics in front of us today are about stimulating investment and about international commerce. I have opinions on both of those topics, as you probably can well gather, but I'll save them until the discussion goes on during the day. I hope that these few remarks that I've made that I hope give us some perspective on where we're coming from and gives you a little bit of perspective about a guy who spent his life in commerce and succeeded in it in Canada and didn't know why he'd succeeded in it until the last 10 years I've been thinking about it and probably still don't quite know why, but I do know it's a very human exchange, value exchange, which is a lot bigger than knowledge and a lot bigger than finance. And in fact, in the end, if you're not financed 100% by your customers, you're not going to be around. So with those few remarks, I wish us all Godspeed here today and great progress in identifying solutions to our commercialization problems, which is what the symposium and the previous symposium was about. Thank you.
Thank you, Doug, for outlining what brings us here and for talking a little bit about some of the challenges that the previous conference has set forth. And thank you for your challenges to us today. I think we have a large menu. And Doug's remarks in the previous symposium poses two questions. What's stopping us? And what can we do about it? So while I present this little token to Doug to thank him for his remarks, I'm going to ask the first panel to come up, and I'll very briefly introduce who you're going to be hearing from and say a little bit about the challenge before them and before us in talking about this next step. So thank you, Doug. In assembling the panels for today, I've had a lot of help, and you've already heard Hamid Etemad and Rod McNaughton referenced in previous remarks. I've just got to say what a wonderful joy it has been the last several months working with them to put today together. But also a huge thank you to all of the people who've agreed to be panelists today. I think the importance of what we're talking about shows in that every single panelist, potential panelist that we approached, said yes. Nobody turned us down. And if I had to make up the panels again, I'd pick exactly the same people. Their bios are in your package. You can read those at your leisure. I could spend the rest of the morning reading them to you, so I'm not going to do that. I'm going to try and move ahead a little more quickly. I'm just going to identify one thing about each person that has stuck out in my mind, and perhaps it's not what they would have chosen, but then they're not here doing this. So what's the two questions? The two questions. What's stopping us, and what can we do about it? And one of the things that is often mentioned, and was certainly highlighted in the Waterloo statement, the Waterloo Declaration, was that financing is a problem. And we know from the work of Josh Lerner and his colleagues and other researchers that risk capital financing is one of the most efficient ways of commercializing ideas that there is. They find that it's three times more effective as direct government grants or direct government spending or direct spending on innovation. And so with that in mind, the morning today, we're going to focus on risk capital. And risk capital comes in two flavors, very broadly speaking. The first kind is angel financing, business angels, individuals who invest their personal money in somebody else's business. Business angels are key in Canada. They're what built Ottawa into being a technology cluster. Business angels were active long before there was a venture capital firm in Ottawa. And to help us explore that, we have four people before you. And I'm just going to say a little word about each of them. Jeffrey Dale, who will be moderating the panel, is an entrepreneur, an investor, and for a part of his life was the president and CEO of the Ottawa OCRI, the Ottawa Economic Development Agency, which, among other things, fosters a group of people who facilitate introductions between entrepreneurs and business angels. And Jeffrey has been a big part of the Ottawa commercialization scene and landscape, I won't say for a long time, but for a while. Michael Arbo is at the New Brunswick Securities Commission. He has been the driver behind an idea in New Brunswick that's now taken shape. And part of that shape is a tax credit for angels in New Brunswick who invest in other people's business. But before that, Michael was a part of the Big Bang in London. He spent 9 years living in London and was a part of the financial deregulation that occurred there in the mid-90s. So he comes with a rich background in securities regulation. Dan Mothersill in Canada, Mr. Angel. Dan is the president and CEO of the National Angel Capitalist Organization. Dan has been involved in the creation of how many angel groups at this point, Dan, just in Ontario? And in the last little while, 12 angel groups Dan has been a part of fostering. If you go to the National Angel Capital Organization website, you'll find materials that will help anyone in any region form an angel group. And he's facilitated angel financing for a number of years and is an entrepreneur before that and an investor. Jean-Marc Sudet. Jean-Marc is probably the most prolific academic researcher on this topic in Canada. He has studied initial public offerings, financing of small firms, from seed financing to going public. He works at University of Laval, and in my opinion, English Canada does not know sufficiently of his work, and I'm absolutely delighted that he can be here to comment on some of these topics. So with all of that, I'll just turn you over to Jeffrey Dale, who take over, and I look forward to what the panel has to say to us today. One last operational detail. This is our talking stick. The native tradition in parts of Canada is that only one person in council could speak. And the person in council who could speak was the person who held the talking stick. So this is the talking stick, and the person who holds this gets to speak. I think for each panel, we're going to hear from the panelists. Then there'll be an opportunity for you to ask questions, to debate, to challenge. And at the end of the day, we'll come back to many of these questions. Jeffrey?
Thank you, Alan. I'm going to change your rules right away, though. Because
you have to fight for it.
There's two talking sticks. As a panel, as the moderator, I will have one of the talking sticks, and we'll also use the other one. You know, when Alan introduced himself, he talked about, you know, he had these wonderful quotations that he started off with, and I was going, oh, geez, maybe I should have some quotations to start off with. So I can't attribute this to anybody, but, you know, all entrepreneurs that are out there trying to raise money have the same expression, the same quote every time. Damn, this is hard to raise money. And, you know, and every single investor that they make a pitch to says, it's my money, it should be hard. And those are the conditions under which we go through this commercialization discussion. And it's very apropos because we're going to talk more about the beginning, the angel investment side of this. And how do we help to improve the success of our entrepreneurs? Because many of them are looking for money right off the start to commercialize their idea. And that's tough, and it should be. Our focus today on the angel side, though, we're going to look at one aspect of it. And that's the role that the public sector, governments, can play. Should they? Shouldn't they? And we'll have some very good debates, I think, on this. I know we had a conference call to plan this, and you know, on the phone, there's no talking stick. And so there was a lot of conversations going back and forth. So we look forward to it. The structure of this is going to be a question and answer. I'm going to provide, we're going to provide about 3 or 4 minutes for each of the panelists to introduce themselves and their expertise on this topic area. I'm going to then start off with a couple of questions, but I encourage you at any time, put up your hand to ask a question of the panelists as well. We want to make sure that this is as interactive as possible. Everybody understand that? I'm getting your questions ready? So with that, what I'm going to do then is pass it over to, I'll start off with Michael here and ask him to introduce himself, and we'll go down the roll.
Okay, thank you. My name is Michael Arbo. I'm the Capital Markets Specialist with the New Brunswick Securities Commission. And so I guess the question then is, why am I here? Well, first off, the New Brunswick Securities Commission is a crown corporation as part of the New Brunswick government. We are the regulators of the securities or the equity markets in the province. You may think of us as the money police. We have a two-point mandate. The first part is to educate and regulate the market, so that's educating people so they're not conned, and to regulate the market so that there's no insider trading and reports are truthful and faithful to what they say. The second part of our mandate is to foster the capital markets. Now, what's interesting is that in Canada, as you are well aware, there's, I think, 12 to 13 regulators out there that do this by every province. In Canada, all the other regulators have the same code. They basically the educate, regulate, and foster. We're the only province that has taken the fostering part of that to heart. And when I first started getting a job, I guess about 5 years ago, I looked at New Brunswick and I said, well, you know, the thing that everyone thinks about when they think about capital markets is, you know, the Toronto Stock Exchange. Well, there are 3,006, at that time, there were about 3,600 publicly traded companies in Canada, and six of those were from New Brunswick. So there was a lot of upside potential there. In fact, adjusting for things like GDP and population, even if we could be like our brothers and sisters to the south of Nova Scotia, instead of that six, we'd probably have about 24. Even if we could be like Newfoundland, who was like just above us, we would have doubled that. We would have had 12. And if we could be like someone like British Columbia, believe it or not, we'd have around 75. So there's a lot of upside potential. But then I quickly realized, and perhaps a lot of the academics would understand this, is that, you know, I remember speaking to David Ganong once, who is an Ivy MBA, and he said, you know, I can do a $1 billion deal, but I haven't got a clue how to do a $200,000 deal. And I was in that position too, like, well, just don't you just sort of go IPO whenever you like? No, you have to, there's a long process. So then I started getting into the process, and that's when we started to figure out, right, well, if we want more IPOs, if we want 24 IPOs in our province, we've really got to start with the mums and dads, then the angels, then the VCs. So my work has started to focus on that. And then what we had to start to figure out was, how do we encourage that? And traditionally what's happened with provinces and governments is that they like to take a rifle approach, and that is, if we change the tax structure, all these entrepreneurs will just pop out of the ground and we'll be all happy. But it's a lot more complicated than that, as I'm sure you'll be finding during the day. So that's my job, is to try to figure out how we can stimulate and get angel investment going from all sides. So we have to get entrepreneurs who want it and know how they have to behave to get it, and we also have to get people who have money to invest in these entrepreneurs. So that's it.
Dan?
Good. Thank you, Michael. My name is Dan Mothersill. I'm president of the National Angel Capital Organization, which is the umbrella organization for all angel groups in Canada. There are about 30 angel groups from coast to coast. I'm also president of what we call the National Angel Organization of Ontario, which looks after the growth, fostering, and building of angel groups within the province. And as I said, we have about 12, including the first alumni-based angel group in all of Canada out of Ryerson University, which has been set up to foster not only student innovation but professorial initiatives and alumni startups as well. And it's been going for about a year and a half now, and an extremely successful enterprise. I also lecture in entrepreneurship at one of the universities, and as I said, or as was said, I'm also an angel investor, an entrepreneur, started a number of companies, sold them off, and am keenly interested, obviously, in the space. I've been an angel investor for about 12 years, and one of the first angel investments I ever made was actually out of a university technology, which taught me a very important lesson. Don't do it. That's where I lost my first lot of money. And paradoxically, I have over the years seen, and I will explain why I said that. Because it was a prof who had decided, brilliant technology, loved it, way ahead of anything else that I could see out there. The problem was the prof took a sabbatical for 1 year to be the CEO of the company. And if it didn't succeed in 1 year, well, it didn't really matter because he was going to go back to what he truly loved to do, and that was to teach and to do research and have a whole bunch of PhD candidates flocking about him, working on innovation. The problem with that is, and by the way, I mean, when Doug was talking about 30 years to build a sizable company, 1 year, it hardly seems like enough. Anyway, I lost all my money in that endeavor, and the prof is a great guy, fabulous guy, University of Waterloo, by the way, and is still doing extremely well. with my money, but never mind. But seeing as we're given to quotes today, I want to leave you with a thought. And this is particularly applicable to universities within Canada, which frankly have become warehouses of innovation. We don't know what to do with it. We know how to create it. We know how to warehouse it. We know how to stockpile it. And by God, we know how to get money for it. But we don't know what to do with it, and we haven't got a clue. Have we advanced? I mean, I really did resonate with so many of the things that you were saying, and not surprising. Have we advanced? No. Is it getting better? Absolutely, fundamentally not. From an angel investor perspective, less than 2% of what is commercialized, sorry, not even of what is commercialized, of what angels actually see in this country comes out of the universities. We spend $12 billion a year, ladies and gentlemen, in this country in R&D. We get squat out of it. That's your tax dollar, that's my tax dollar. $12 billion a year. And what we have is, I mean, Canada, by the way, is not a country. It's a series of warring city-states. When it comes to commercialization, we have a number of warring interest groups. Those who do quasi-incubators, those who are bureaucrats, those who are universities, those who are entrepreneurs, those who are consultants which have all the answers, not. We exist in silos. Getting back to what I was saying about innovation, and I'm going to pass the baton, is that, and this will really sum up anything that I'm going to say, that the net value, we're given to quotes here, everybody's doing quotes, so I'll haul out a quote. Actually, one of my favorite quotes. The net value of a killer idea is zero, unless you can turn it into a profitable business. The net sum value of a killer idea is zero, unless you can turn it into a profitable business. End of quote. W. Daniel Mothersill. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Jean-Marc Suret. I am an academic from Laval University, but a former entrepreneur. My research is on small business finance with three dimensions. The first one is regulation and the very particular situation of the Canadian market, the public Canadian market, the TSX. And what we observe briefly is that we are the country with the lower listing requirement in the world. Half of the company go public with very, very small amount of money and very small amount of equity. And what we observe is that people who invest in this company very generally in 80% of the cases lose money. So it's not really a good idea to invest in very small public companies in Canada, in public offering as in private placements. The second part of my interest, my research interest, is tax incentives and public policy. And during 3 years, I have the opportunity to evaluate each program the Quebec government implement in the area of small business. And all these programs were based on upfront tax credit. They do not like our report, because generally we evidence that upfront tax credit had very negative effects. The last part of our work, very close to the interest of this panel and this discussion, is the migration of firms toward the U.S. We are looking at public companies that move to the U.S., who have a huge number of companies each year that move to the U.S., public companies that migrate to the U.S., and some of them are after that attracted by the U.S. market by merger or acquisition or things like that. But we observe also the same phenomenon for private companies that move to the U.S. for financial reasons, but also for commercial reasons. So they are Canadian at the beginning, they are financing, the R&D is financed by public funds in Canada. They get financed by public programs, and after that they move to the U.S. So it's the other point, the other area of our research. Thank you.
Thank you. So you can see we've got a number of various positions on the panel. And once again, I encourage you to come up with your questions. I'm going to start it off by a very open-ended question, which is, what role should government play, if any, in increasing the angel capital investments that are going on within Canada? And I'll start off with Dan.
Oh, lucky me. First of all, maybe I'd like to start off with kind of defining what angel capital is, because it's really not necessarily all that well understood. And the role that angel capital plays within the funding ecosystem within Canada. Angel investors are, under the rules of the OSC and other jurisdictions, are theoretically high net worth individuals who can afford to lose it all. And that does happen. And there are certain thresholds and whatever, so they don't have to make investments by prospectus and whatever. Anyway, people who have money to lose. Angel investing is God's way of telling you you've got too much money. Angel investing is about twice what venture capital invests in Canada. Angel investing over the last 10 to 15 years has become an asset class. To quote an Industry Canada stat, it's be somewhere between 2.2 and 2.4 billion. Is that right? Yes. There's pioneering work that was done, which I quote, not you, but Industry Canada, because, you never mind. But it was your work, and I know it was. Which is a significant amount of money. However, it barely begins to satisfy the dally of death at the funding void between what is out there required in terms of small to medium-sized enterprises and what the capacity of angel investors have or VCs have in order to fund this. So that's where angels play. I've become an asset class. I've become much more sophisticated in the last 10 to 15 years for a whole variety of reasons, mostly because they've had to be, because a lot of angel investors got tired of losing money. We don't usually have a lot of family money necessarily in Canada that invests. Angel investors usually come from an entrepreneurial class. They've been there, done that before, built businesses, sold some businesses, they're still active in a number of businesses, and they tend to have a portfolio of companies that they've invested in, 1 to 3 to 5 to 6 to a colleague of mine who's into 18 right now, which is a little piggy, but never mind. So that's sort of where we are. And angels are increasingly, that funding gap that I talked about, are increasingly called upon to provide more money because venture capitalists are really out of early stage investing in this country. And I'm no expert in venture capital, and I don't pretend to be, but I just know that the reality is that they're not doing seed and early stage financing anymore in this country. There's a lot of reasons for it, and I'm sure I know there's some experts in this room. So back to the question, what can government do? It's really more, and I hinted in my brief opening remarks, it's really not government doing more, it's more realignment of what it is already doing in terms of our money, and I think that's an important distinction, because sometimes we kind of look to Gov and say, well, it's Gov money. No, it's not. It's our money. Who gets to decide how it's spent, how it's invested? Well, I would argue that all of us in this room, all of us who are angel investors, all of us who are entrepreneurs, and all of us who are educators, particularly around entrepreneurship, I think have a role to play. So if we look at that $12 billion a year, recognizing that almost none of that is spent on commercialization within this country. And we talked about globalization, in other words, taking a good idea and turning it into a real business. Very little of that is spent. And as was mentioned earlier, the importance of international and global sales. If very little of that is spent on commercialization, almost nothing is spent on globalization, of creating what I call micro-multinationals. We don't all have to be RIMs. In order to, we don't all have to manufacture, sell, market crackberries in order to be successful. We don't have to be $15 billion companies. What about a whole plethora of $100 million companies? Is that possible? Of course it is. By the way, we also don't want to all be Nortels, but that's another story. So really it comes down to what is government's role. And I think government's role is to really understand a lot better than it does, because it keeps on retreading again and again. We've got to put more money into R&D, more money into R&D. That's not where the action is. I've had the privilege of crossing this country as president of the NACO over the last 7 years to really begin to understand that from all different communities, both in the private sector and from the educational community, we are awash in innovation. We're some of the best people in the world in terms of innovation. We've got some of the best engineers in the world, in Canada. Bill Gates comes every year to the University of Waterloo, right, to cherry pick our best, some of our best and some of our brightest. Doesn't go to U.S. universities, he comes up here. Well, he can get us cheaper, but never mind. We've got some.
It's another issue.
Well, actually, with the Canadian dollar now, you know, it's not doing bad. And there's a reason that they do that. We're really good at this stuff. We suck at selling. We don't have a clue how to sell. We don't have an entrepreneurial class in this country. If you look at our schools, for instance, and oh, I'm going to get myself in trouble.
Yes.
Right? Which?
Forwards.
Yeah, there we go. This is why I get off a lot of university Christmas card lists, but never mind. Our focus on businesses around MBAs. There's nothing wrong with MBAs, but it has nothing to do with entrepreneurship, or at least very little to do. And that's where our focus is. Nothing wrong with it. Play an important and vital role, but it has nothing to do with entrepreneurship. We have one PhD program within all of Canada in entrepreneurship. I bet nobody in this room knows where it is, except maybe Jeff. You and I talked about it this morning, and that came as a surprise to you, right? University of Calgary. So we talk about the importance of entrepreneurship. It is lip service, because we really don't do anything about it. I have sat with the president of a major university, a top five, maybe three, not McGill. McGill's number one, we know this. I read the surveys. 16th in the world, number one in Canada. Well done. Who actually turned to me with a very straight face and said, well, how do we do this? I mean, you know, jaw hit the table. And I said, one of your most important, well-subscribed classes in your university is by a guy who volunteers to teach entrepreneurship. It is oversubscribed. He doesn't pay. He isn't paid. He volunteers to do this. And started to go down the list of people who are academics who actually dabble, and went on as one will for some time. But I mean, this is one of the leading universities in this country, and I'm sitting there with the president who asked the question, how do we create? We don't have an entrepreneurial class in this country. So in terms of what Gov can do, both federally and provincially, is to take a look at all the resources and to begin to realign some of this stuff. It's not rocket science. But you have experts, right? Both within academia and certainly within the entrepreneurial class. Yeah, I'm looking at you, Doug. Who know what needs to be done? Do we get a fair hearing? No. Is angel investing even understood at this, you know, in this country? It is not. I sit at standing, present to standing committees on science and technology in Ottawa. And how many times have I sat there with the standing committee, who is charged with some of the commercialization, to yet again explain what an angel investor is and the role that they play within Canada? Where have we been, people? So the very short answer is a little realignment might really help.
Talk to Michael about, I think he has some definite positions on what government's role should be.
Okay, well, I do agree with the realignment, and certainly in New Brunswick, we've been very interesting with that. We have, and it sort of leads to the next bit of it, is that in New Brunswick we have a tax credit, the Small Business Investor Tax Credit. What's interesting about that is that the government's, I don't know how they pulled it off, but the government's decided that they're not going to pick the winner. In other words, unlike BC or Newfoundland or, those are the two I can think of right off the top of my head. What's that?
Manitoba.
You know, if you're not doing IT, biotech, ecotourism, don't come to us. In New Brunswick, it's open, and trust me, when I say it's open to everything. They've done beauty parlors, flower shops, biotech, IT, you know, you name it. I think what's also good about that is it's letting the public decide where the winners are, or the public decide what should be invested in, as opposed to the government choosing. So it's taking that decision away from the government, which in one way is good for them because they can't make any political mistakes. And just on that, I'll just sort of give you an idea. We started that program started in 2003, and there were 6 applicants that year. Now in the last financial year, there were 79 applicants, representing about 353 investors. The value of investment, first off, when you invest, you're allowed to invest up to $250,000 and get a 30% tax credit on that. When the program first started out, it was $50,000. It's gone up to $250,000. What's interesting about, even though the number's gone up, that big number has gone up, the average investment's still $20,000. So what I'm trying to advocate now in New Brunswick is that we have no cap. Because it'll still be $20,000. However, there'll be people that will put in at the top end. And once again, it can go into whatever you like. And as one of my colleagues in Newfoundland said, all money is good money, especially when you're looking at things like startups. So as I said, you know, it's gone from zero to great. The value of investments in the first year was about $900,000. Last year it was $12 million. And then it's a bit of math here for my colleague. New Brunswick, putting New Brunswick in perspective, you know, we're 1.7% of Canada's GDP, so we're a rounding error, okay? So to put that in perspective, if you were to compare that $12 million in New Brunswick, if Ontario was to pull off the same trick and have the same take-up, that would be approximately $258 million. And if you leverage that through lines of credit, et cetera, you'd almost have about $1.3 billion of investment in SMEs. So, you know, that's what we're doing. So there is a role for government, but it's not the government to make the decision. It's to provide the incentives.
Do you want to say something quickly,
yeah.
Dan, on the way by?
Really quickly, in terms of some of the, just to pick up on what Michael said, tax incentives right around the world in those jurisdictions that have been proven to increase the amount of private to leverage the amount of private equity to encourage more people to get into the game. And it's in terms of job creation and tax base and whatever, it's been proven to pay back a number of times. Within the province of Ontario, a $2.5 million investment over the last 2 years, we have been able to leverage 17 times. Not bad. So if you wanted to create, that's out of $2.5 million. So I asked the question, what would it take to leverage $100 million? Well, you do the math. What would it take to leverage $200 million in terms of government incentive, et cetera, et cetera? There are a lot of mechanisms in terms of taking oil and gas and doing flow-through shares for a lot of different industries. There are about 3 or 4 things that government could really do. The problem is that you have to have federal-provincial cooperation in a lot of these things, and the provinces won't do it unless the feds do it, and the feds won't do it unless the provinces do it. And it is a bit of a conundrum, but never mind.
Over to Jean-Marc to tell us a little bit about the research that he has seen on this.
Yeah, what I can do is perhaps a survey of what the other governments in the world are doing for business angels. And we have 6 or 7 types of interventions. First one, fiscal incentives. I will describe what the other governments are doing. Support to business angel networks. It's new but growing type of intervention. Securities legislation changes. It's very interesting to note that the Dodd-Frank Act was just amended to provide more incentive for business angels, because in the initial version, the description of unaccredited investors was reduced. And the angel association in the U.S. represent, and they gained their point, and the law was changed for the business angels. Capacity building, it's entrepreneur training and angels training, co-investment vehicle, and equity guarantee scheme. Fiscal incentives. In Europe, most countries have some scheme of tax advantage. In the UK, you know the income enterprise investment schemes. This is the only program where we have several evaluations, and generally these evaluations are positive. In France, Société Unipersonnelle d'Investissement à Risque, it's a scheme which gives some incentive, some tax incentive to people who invest indirectly in small firms. In Belgium, no capital gain tax, so it's a great advantage. And also, this is for people, and also for funds. They have a program to exempt the funds from tax incentive. Iceland business expansion scheme and low tax rate. Luxembourg, Italy, and so on. Quebec, we had a very bad experience with a business angel scheme. It was the program was Quebec, Quebec Business Investment Companies. We have to analyze this program, and what we observed, it was an upfront credit to invest in a holding company who hold the share of the operating companies. And what we observe after analyzing all the files financing in the program is that most people that profit from the programs are relatives, friends, the manager himself. And we do not find many angels in this program. So the second point is that the performance of the firms in the program was very, very poor. And most of them failed after a few years. And the third point we evidence is that the selection of the firms was very poor. And in a case, we observed that three firms in the same area and with the same product profit from the program. So it was closed after our report. In the U.S., 20 or 25 states implemented tax program for business angels. And recently, the federal government in the U.S. implemented the Investment Incentive Act this summer to provide a tax break of 25% for equity investment in company that already is qualified for federal research and development grant program. So we have a lot of countries and jurisdictions with tax incentives. Generally, they are not upfront programs. Because fiscal incentives have limitation, do have limitation, negative effect of upfront, I totally agree with the learner assessment that this kind of program should be not implemented, should be avoided. Because essentially they attract dumb money, people who are not involved, who are not really angels, and who don't provide expertise to the firm. In case all fiscal incentives are implemented, the design is very, very important. This is also a consideration in the book of Lerner. The design of incentive program is very crucial. And, for example, in the U.S., there are recommendations to get better specification to the scheme, to the enterprise management incentives, to get better incentive to active angels. And I think that specific well-designed program can work better than overall program. But tax incentives are not enough, and all the literature is agree with that, because there are also impediments to the angels' activity. And the first one is the lack of opportunities. in the survey recently published by Colin Masson, he wrote that one of the most consistent findings in research on business angels is that the majority is unable to find sufficient investment opportunities. So there are complementary action for government. The first one is the assistance to business angel networks to reduce the asymmetry of information and improve the deal flow. And the second one is the investment readiness and formation for angels and for entrepreneurs. Another impediment is the difficulty to finance a second round because angels do not have a limited amount of money available, and the solution in this case is matching funds. Support to bonds is becoming very common in Canada, but in Europe, they are generally backed at the local level because they have often a local dimension in several states in the U.S., Wisconsin, Washington, and so on. In Europe, they are often backed by the governments. There are approximately 300 banks in Europe. In Canada, I understand that the federal is involved, and recently the Quebec governments. And they are very interesting because they can play a crucial role in improving the readiness and improving the angels' training. So several governments have also implemented some kind of help to the training program, and now we have in the world several training programs very well structured. In Europe, there are the Ready for Equity, for Angels in the U.S. with the Kauffman Foundation, we have the Angel Capital Education Foundation, and all these programs work apparently very well. Last point, co-investment vehicle. There are government finance and funds which leverage investment doing by the angels. We have only one good evaluation of this fund. This is, I think, the Scottish funds. Evidence are mixed. Indeed, this fund provide the leverage and increase the amount available for the firms, but there are two limitations noted by the report. The first one is the lack of opportunities. The second is that the role of the angel, the crucial role of the angel involved in the activity of the firms, is largely diluted when a part of the financing is provided by non-angels. So it's a brief survey of what the other governments are doing.
Thank you. I was just going to say, though, that what you've heard today, what you're hearing that's been the panelists is that there are a variety of programs and things that can be done. But we've heard about New Brunswick. We've heard about Quebec. We've heard about Manitoba, Alberta, BC, all different models, all at the provincial level. And what we haven't heard about is any federal programs to tie it all together. And I know that, are we creating a new version of have and have-not provinces? I know, coming from Ottawa, doing a startup in Ottawa, many times we had to move our company across the river to Gatineau to be able to take advantage of programs that were available in a different province. So I guess throwing the question back to the panel here is that can we have an efficient system of government support without the federal government playing? Or are we creating we talked about it in our conference call, almost a tax arbitrage on some of these incentives. Michael, do you want to start?
Yeah, I think when I first started talking about sort of taking the rifle approach, and I think to do a federal approach, I personally don't think it'll work because, New Brunswick, Prince Edward Island is even better. Prince Edward Island is not Ontario. I don't even think Prince Edward Island would be a suburb of Ontario, of Toronto. So I think to take the bullet approach, I really don't think it'll work. I think you really have to maybe dispense the money or the ideas or the programs either provincially or within regions. So, for example, I could certainly see Maritime, that being PEI, Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, or perhaps Atlantic Canada having one sort of program, and then the different provinces having different things. And I think that would also, you know, there's different universities, despite the we have great universities in Canada, I think they all work on slightly different systems. So certainly if you want to do the commercialization thing, I don't really think you could just have one federal norm. I really think it's got to be site or niche specific. And also when you think of, you know, if you look at the great things that the Internet has brought, I mean, it's brought a lot of neat things in my mind. It's, you know, it's allowing the niche player and people to sort of expect the niche now. They don't expect a one size fits all. So, you know, I guess to cut the long story short is that I don't think one federal idea would work. And if we did do the one federal idea, and this is also a problem that the politicians face, I guess, is because I must admit it was several years ago, I guess about 3 years ago, Industry Canada wrote this really great report about angel investing and how they could stimulate it and all this sort of stuff. So I phoned the guy up. Interesting enough, I was the only person to phone him up. So I thought, well, gee, obviously the OSC is not doing that. But I was the only guy to phone him up, and I said, you know, what you got is really, really interesting. And I said, let's make New Brunswick your test case. I said, we're a small province. It'll only take $5 million. And we can, and if it works in Ontario, in New Brunswick, then you can take it across for us again. So we can't do that. This has to be a national program. So rather than experimenting with having a little microcosm experiment, you know, they have to spend $100 or $200 million to do the experiment instead of five. You know, that's our tax dollars. So that's the problems they've got with trying to do a national program. It's got to, you know, go big or go home. No. No, because there's another problem with politics, is that that report was written under the previous Liberal government. Stephen Harper got in, those ideas aren't any good anymore. So, although, interesting enough, Stephen Harper's crowd then did another report, which was very, very similar, but there you go.
It almost begs the question, when you ask the question, does the federal government have a role to play in commercialization? Well, the obvious answer, I think everybody would probably agree, yeah, it probably does, because a lot of that $12 billion that is spent in R&D indeed comes from the feds. And there's been lots of reports and lots of studies and lots of research done, and I'll be darned if I know what has happened with all that stuff. So, and you sit and it is perplexing. Because should it have a role? Yes. Is there a framework for that role? Dozens of them. Is there the political will to do it? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. But more importantly, is there the bureaucratic role to make it happen? And I think far too often we put our emphasis on our political masters in terms of convincing them that this is a good thing to do. We don't lobby. We can't lobby. But in terms of informing them how to do it, I think one of the solutions, because goodness knows many other things have been tried, I really have come to the conclusion that one of the solutions is to begin to work, and this is going to take time, with the bureaucrats who, doesn't matter who's in power, they're still with us. And to begin to work some of these programs on the bureaucratic level, because they do advise elected government officials. And I don't think, and I'm talking from a National Angel Capital Organization perspective, I don't think we have done enough work on the federal level to help realize and to help get implemented the plethora of reports and studies and analysis that have been done.
Yeah, from all the literature I have read on these topics, one point seems to me very important, is the crucial role of angel networks. And perhaps one of the less costly measures for the government can be to help business angel networks. Because, for example, in Quebec, we have a small network. It's actually too small to be very effective. And they lack money. And 10 years, 12 years ago, I conducted the first analysis of business angels in Quebec. And one of my conclusions is that they are numerous, but they are alone. They don't know, some other angels, but they are not very well organized. And this organization can really improve the performance of the angel financing. And for me, it's a measure that can be taken before to implement tax credit and things like that to increase the amount of money.
What about the audience? Do you have any questions from the audience for the panelists?
I agree with you.
Mr. Collinson, I will. You were... Okay.
Jean-Marc, in all your work looking at the different types of programs that governments are doing around the world, our federal government today is scratching their heads and trying to make a decision, a very tough decision. They're trying to decide indirect support versus direct support. In your studies, have you seen anyone measure the commerce coming out or the success of the companies? You mentioned in Quebec a lot of the companies failed. Is there anyone measuring how companies succeed in these different regimes? Is there any knowledge coming up so people trying to make those decisions pick one?
We need the talking stick back, I think, for
people
here.
Sorry, John.
We don't observe many success in every program we analyze. The only cases of success which are put in front by the government in Quebec are firms like Jean Coutu or Bombardier or things like that. But this firm profits from the QSSP program, a program that provides a grant at the IPO level. But in this case, I think that the program was totally absolutely no effect on this firm. What I measure, for example, is the amount of money they give as dividend during their growth and the amount of money they take from the market in the program, and they give more dividend than the money they take in the market. So we have no evidence that the program was very efficient. But there are very particular cases, and they are back to the 17. But recently, we do not have evidence of good firms that profit from governmental programs to increase their sales foreign and things like that.
Doug?
My question is going to be a real left field or some field question. And the question is, can money fix the problems at all? Can we find any financial mechanism that will fix the problem? And the reason I'm asking it that way is because I believe that the fundamental problem is that we have very, very few enterprise or commerce competent people who are, they're entrepreneurial. 25% of the population is entrepreneurial. They want to do something different and they want to be on with it and get on with it. But I think the studies that Jeff and I have done have indicated that, in fact, most of the people that start up enterprises don't know anything about enterprises, and they think they have to do R&D, and that the way you do R&D is to raise funds to do R&D. And so they get into funding right away. So to condition my question a little bit, I want to say that a company that got started here in Montreal, that's now in Calgary, called Smart Technologies, that just went public this year, was a company where David and his wife started out here in Montreal. They couldn't afford a bed or anything in their apartment because they were doing on-the-side consulting to try and get Smart Technology started. They didn't ever have any funding at the beginning. They just starved and worked on it. They were determined, And there you are. Smart has just gone public. It's a company that's nearing $1 billion a year, one of the sweet companies for Canada in some ways. Will we keep them in Canada? Who knows? But one of the things that I often say, particularly after the studies that we've done, is that if you're starting a company, you should avoid financing. Do everything you can to avoid getting financing because it interferes with what you want to do. The best financing you can have is from your customers. Find them early, get money from them soon, and if you're like David Martin and his wife, they actually got money from other customers than the ones that they wanted in their business. But they used that money to get on to their business. The big problems that we have in Canada is that our financial institutions are huge institutions in the company, that country, that influence everybody's thinking and influence all the business schools. It's not in their interest to say what I'm saying. Don't get financing. Find a way to get money from a customer. Is that the real problem, that money can't solve it?
Anybody but Dan? Dave?
Give me that mic.
I think with all due respect, I think you're partly right. And I think that you have, and there are lots of exceptions to the fact that you really don't, a lot of companies don't need money. In fact, one of the first things a smart angel investor will do is say, look, what's the skin in the game that the entrepreneur has? Have they sold their house? Have they maxed their credit cards? Have they sold their kids for medical experiments? If they can answer that, that's a good start. And would it be optimal for the company if they could finance it all themselves? Absolutely. The problem is that certainly in the last 10 to 15 years, I've seen so many companies die in the vine or get sold off really very much. The technology gets sold off, not the companies. Because they're lacking that critical, you know, sometimes it's as little as, you know, $100,000 to help them to survive, to take it to the next level. They've exhausted Aunt Martha, right? The banks won't give them an LOC, and that's a whole other problem in terms of our banking institutions or whatever, which is a sidebar conversation. But I've seen some, money is not the elixir to all entrepreneurial problems. In fact, angel money is sometimes of secondary importance to the mentorship that angels bring. Because remember I said that angels come from entrepreneurial class. It's that mentorship because they've been there, done that before, right? To help educate management and sometimes to step in because we see a lot of CEOs who are really, of young companies, who are really CTOs and should never be put in charge of sales and marketing and the infrastructure of a business. So, yeah, I think in an ideal world, I totally agree with you, except I see far too many exceptions that just for a little bit of money, right, from an angel, they could really take it to the next level. And I also agree with you that I see far too many companies that are become codependent, right, upon other people, other people's money. That if, geez, we don't get it, it sometimes can take the incentive out of it. But I think the real answer is a blend to what you're saying and to the need for angel investors. Just a thought.
I know Tom first and then Mario at the back.
Thanks, Jeff. Just to support what Doug said in his last set of remarks with a little bit of information, Jeff will publish in about, 6 weeks, Jeff, your annual R&D Spenders Top Innovating Companies. And there's a database that Research Money publishes that typically lists about 700 Canadian companies that together spend about 80% of the private sector spending on R&D. Of those companies, somewhere between 2 and 300 out of close to 700 have an R&D intensity R&D spending as a percentage of sales revenue, which is over 100%. These are the ones that Doug was talking about. They depend on somebody other than their customers for their R&D.
Did you have a question in there?
Yeah, that's the size of the problem one has to address.
Okay. Mary?
Thank you. I'd like to comment and ask a viewpoint on the question of what is the real problem? Is it money or is it people? And to build on Doug's point, I've been a VC for 7 years here in Montreal down the street. I was a general partner in a $100 million fund. We started about 35 companies in Montreal. A lot of them failed, and with my partners, we analyzed what was the cause of failure. It's all about people. It's about management, and it's about dysfunctional boards of management. And today, I run a group, the Center for Commercialization of Research in Toronto. It's part of the Ontario Centers of Excellence. It's funded by the federal government, the Network of Centers of Excellence. And we started with a blank page, helping emerging companies from academia to grow. And contrary to many government programs, we didn't have a program. Our program was what is needed by the entrepreneurs. And so we started to talk to young entrepreneurs, older entrepreneurs with new companies. They came to us asking for money. We said, well, let's sit down and look at what you do. Money is the last thing you need today. You need to do these six things before needing money, and one of them is management. So this led us to a program that is called Embedded Executives. And what we do, we'll put a full-time executive in a startup for a period of 6 to 12 months to accomplish something very specific. And it's an experiment. We're running an experiment, basically. But after 2 years, our success rate based on the milestones we have established is 95%. With the right person in the right company at the right time, it can move mountains. That money will never move. And I think that a little bit of money could be as little as $50,000 for a few months or $100,000 for longer can make a lot of difference. We have co-invested in some of the companies with many Andrew Zandi Weichs. Is now on our board of management, and it's really all about management. And one of the problems in Canada is that we don't have the serial entrepreneurs that we see in other countries. In Canada, part of the culture is that when many entrepreneurs, when they succeed, they are a bit gun shy to reinvest in other enterprises. We have a few, but I think there's a cultural shift that is needed. So my question is, I do have a question at the end of this long winded comment, is do you see in what you do serial entrepreneurs coming into play in your activities?
Who wants to take that? No? Dan? We have one more question, too. So.
Yeah, okay. Really quickly. From an angel investment point of view and from my constituency, it is really populated only by serial entrepreneurs, people who have done one or more companies. I know people who have done up to a dozen companies that they have been involved with and grown and had a liquidity event. So that's sort of the basis. So, yeah, serial entrepreneurs, we need to attract more of them and to increase to formalize the process, which all the surveys in Canada, the U.S., and Europe have shown really increases the effectiveness. And I totally agree, and I am familiar with the embedded executive program, and I think it's brilliant. But I think it's a blend of, and money does not solve all the problems. You put the emphasis always on people first. In fact, you know, from an angel investment point of view, you don't invest in technology. You don't invest in science. You don't invest in product, and you don't invest in service. You invest in the people first. And they've got to be people who know how to run businesses, which is one of the reasons why angel investors often step in and help out for a period of time. But, yeah, serial entrepreneurs.
Yeah, I'll just add to that. I've heard a stat for the province of Nova Scotia, and someone estimated there are serial entrepreneurs, another nickname for them is gazelles. Someone told me there's about 26 gazelles in Nova Scotia. Okay, so the population is about 1.5 million people. So there's 26 people that are dubbed as serial entrepreneurs. Saying that, I think between 2000 and 2005-ish, something like that, those 26 people created 10% of all the new jobs in the province. Fantastic. So then the government policy is, well, maybe forget everybody else, we'll just give money to the gazelles. Can government pull that off? Once again, no. No. So they should be helped. They are out there. But they're a very, very small percentage of the population.
We have one more question at the back. It'd be the last one. Tyler.
So a comment and then a question. First of all, there were some mention of the amount of money that's spent by the federal government on research. You know, there have been policy changes in recent times to try to direct more and more of that towards graduate students. Now, maybe that is part of the investing in people aspect, but I wonder what you think about that issue. But then secondly, too, in recent times we've had about the most stimulating environment in terms of low interest rates and high property values that theoretically is creating opportunities for people to be, you know, accessing funds for business development in those areas. Do you see any impact of that? Because the concern is when times change and when interest rates aren't so low and if property values don't maintain or don't grow significantly, is that going to impact the sort of business development going forward? So really two questions there.
So who'd like to handle that? Who'd like? Jean-Marc? They're volunteering, Jean-Marc.
Oh, it's me again. Yeah, absolutely. If I understand the question, the economy has a very direct bearing. The state of the economy has a very direct bearing on what angels will and will not invest in. Angels will take usually about 10 to 20, sometimes as high as 25% of their disposable income and invest in small to medium-sized enterprises. So they've got an awful lot of money also out there in other forms, in stock markets and whatever. And when the economy goes bad, angels will, like just about everybody else, head for the trenches and bury their money in the mattress or something in low interest bearing but secure. We've had a tough couple of years in terms of angel investing. That's the bad news. The good news is, really starting about 6 to 8 months ago, we're starting to see that come back with some real enthusiasm. So we're starting to see a lot more companies being invested in right across the board.
Does anybody have a comment on their graduate studies? Or
no, I was just going to add on to what Dan was saying. You know, I think someone mentioned that, you know, angel investment is starting to be seen as an asset class, and I think that maybe certainly for my industry and stuff like that, that's great because the S&P 500 index over the past 10 years has returned negative 31%. over the past 10 years, turned negative 31%. So, you know, it's starting to make things like angel investing appear more popular. Also, what's starting to happen is that because certainly where we live, banks are starting shutting down. They're shutting down branches. They're reducing the amount of loans they're doing. We're seeing, like, with our small business investor tax credit, I think last year it went up 44%. From what I understand, they're doing about two applications a week now. So that suggests another 100, which would be another about 20 or 25% more. So it, unfortunately by default, but it is starting to happen, I think. That's what our current environment is starting to do, I think.
Can you repeat? What we know about the return of the various forms of private equity returned negative returns for the last 10 or 15 years. This is true in the U.S., in Canada, for private equity, classical, and for venture capital. The only class of private equity that return positive returns is angels, but angels acting as a group. This is the only category. So it's very important to let know that, and it's also very important for policymakers to capitalize on that, because when you have class of assets like private equity that returns negative returns year after year, similar venture capital, minus 3% of rate of return during 10 years in Canada, this is not sustainable. Only angels acting as a group provide a sustainable rate of returns.
27.5% IRR. 27.5% IRR, internal rate of return. Yeah.
In the U.S., they give the number of 49% approximately for the groups.
Yeah. So with that, our time is up. And if you'll bear with me, just to summarize in terms of what our discussions went on, our question was, what are the best ways to stimulate additional angel capital investment? And we've talked about, on the supply side from the public sector, yes, there is a role for government to play. It's that catalyst to catalyze the market for angel investing. And Doug, I know markets don't write purchase orders or don't invest, but the market that they're looking at is very focused, as we've seen from New Brunswick, and that is to focus on specific incentives directly for the investors that are putting the dollars in. And that's a result of you making your investment that the government's going to come into play. But I think what we're hearing from everyone here is that the more important side is the demand side. And that's the demand side of how do we train our entrepreneurs better? What do we need to do to have an entrepreneurial class in this country? And how do we help to make it so that our entrepreneurs are more successful? Because money isn't the only one. Although if you ask them, it is. But we need to make sure that we do more in terms of creating that demand for the money and for success, because success will drive more money to be invested into it. So with that, I want to thank the panelists. Thank you, everyone, for participating. Thank you for all the work. And thank the audience for your questions. Thank you.